everyone, and welcome to the Every Movie Ever podcast. My name is Ben Gross.
And my name is Rob McFarlane. Welcome to the show, a movie podcast slash mental health check-in for two broken brain best friends talking around their problems, but not about their problems.
Never.
Whilst laughing at movies. Ben, given that this is a thinly veiled mental health check-in, we need to start with the more important thing before we get to what we're doing, how you're doing. But I feel like this should also be a physical health check-in.
Okay.
Because I think that rarely this week, your mental health is the second problem.
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty positive at the minute. I'm just fucking ill.
Swear jar, one.
Ah! And now I'm worse. I'm just ill. Other than that, I'm all right. Yeah. How are you, buddy?
Yeah.
Come on, spill it.
Spout that, really.
Spill it.
No, it's good. It's good. I have. It feels good to have come clean.
Oh, okay.
I feel so much better. Wow.
That's good, man. There we go.
What are we doing this week, Ben?
In our quest to cover every David Fincher movie ever, we've locked ourselves in the panic room, baby.
We've got a lot to get through this episode, so we're going to get into how David Fincher doesn't care about this film.
Is this the perfect date movie?
The 100 ways that David Fincher overprepared this movie.
The 101 things that went wrong.
Why Jodie Foster is an acting goddess who we cannot relate to.
And how David Fincher will always be his worst enemy.
Where Fincher at, buddy? Like, what'd that man do? I've got some notes on this, bud.
What Fincher been doing?
Do you remember last time when I was like, well, basically he just launched straight into the next film?
Yeah.
Well, he basically did that again, except...
Amazing.
Except he directed a music video for the ever incredible A Perfect Circle.
Awesome.
For the song Judith.
Ooh.
Absolutely mint video.
Great video.
Probably the last use of his Fight Club aesthetic with the bleach bypass process and all that kind of dirty graininess. He was shortlisted by Columbia Pictures as one of the potential directors to helm Spider-Man.
Ooh, okay.
Now get this. His pitch was an older, experienced version of Spider-Man in his adult years.
Yeah.
Post the adolescent stuff.
Yeah.
He wanted character-driven, drama-oriented tone.
Amazing.
With a 10-minute title sequence tackling Peter Parker's backstory and featuring Green Goblin killing Gwen Stacy.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
He later said of his pitch, I went in and told them what I might be interested in doing, and they hated it.
I still kind of want to see that film, man.
Right? Well, if you want to see that film, there's a film that never got made called Passengers. And I know some of you out there might be thinking that that's the...
Chris Pratt
and Jennifer Lawrence incel on a boat. But it's not.
Yeah. It's super fun film.
Right. It's no, this is set in 1987. And I'll quote, for 3 years, people on Earth have been subject to the will of the... passengers, inverted commas, intangible beings who usurp human bodies temporarily and without warning and do nothing but play and cause havoc. People being ridden are ignored by others, and when they are freed, the experience by social convention is ignored by all.
Ooh.
God, I want to see that film.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. What?
But instead, what if it was set on a spaceship and it was Chris Pratt?
Yeah.
Fuck zoning Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah, to be fair, sentencing her to death because she's a bit fit.
Two, damn it.
I think it's three. I might have knocked one out in there by accident.
Oh, less about that after we just talked about Passengers.
Amazing.
Now, when did this film come out, Ben?
Hold on 1 second. That caught me so off guard. That was amazing. It's 2002, buddy.
Oh, is it?
It is. Eminem is providing an era of hip-hop that we won't love as much as it deserves until years later when we've seen how bad it gets after this. George W. Bush is trying to find allies for an invasion of Iraq that he promises, for realsies, guys, will do really, really well for super series. We're all bored of playing Snake on our Nokia 3310s because it doesn't have microtransactions. Yet, we can buy swappable covers for the phone, though.
Oh, classic.
And that's pretty good time. That's a pretty good time. David Fincher is given $50 million to make The Panic Room, buddy.
Woo! It's, again, Panic Room. I know you love slapping a the in front of things.
Just put a the in there, you know what I mean? The Beatles makes it better. The Kinks, even better. Kinks sounds off. The Kinks, I'm in. Know what I mean?
All right, fine.
Yeah.
You've seen this film for years, right? You love this film. You've known this film since 2002.
No, this is my first time watching it. shockingly, I've not been massive into Fincher.
Okay.
A few of his films have caught me and I've been sort of like, yeah, buddy.
Right, okay.
This one, hadn't seen it. And in 2024, watching Panic Room for the first time.
Right.
Aggressively fine. Super middle of the road. Like, the story is thin and kind of nonsensical at times, and that's fine. That's, I get it.
Right.
It's entertaining enough to get to the end.
Right.
But I've been spoiled by decades.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Decades of home invasion movies.
Watching this in 2024 is very close to what I imagine the experience of watching Avatar will be like in 20 years.
Yeah.
Like, this film pushed forward directorial techniques and, like, it was an insane-looking film for the time.
Yeah.
All the stuff that he does in this film is now totally de rigueur. Like, everyone does that stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So,
but this is why.
Right, but yeah. Like, Avatar in 20 years, people were like, yeah, and? But it's like, yeah, but at the time, you went to the cinema and it was like fireworks. It was wow.
Yeah.
3D was working. Yeah, and?
Yeah.
This, same, when I watched it was a perfectly fine film, but I do... I wasn't like, wow, what a great film Panic Room is.
Yeah.
But I do remember it being one of the first films I ever watched where the look of the film stuck with me.
Oh, okay.
Like, suddenly I was aware of more than plot or acting as being part of the ingredients of a film.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, wow, it's also how the frame looks. Like, what's in the frame? How is it composed?
It's like me when I saw my first 35mm film. I was like, wow, reds are red, huh?
Now, for the benefit of those people that haven't seen this and aren't planning to, all the people that have seen it and just don't plan on rewatching it in order to listen to this episode, we should break down what happens in it. Now, Ben, we spoke about the film earlier and you were like,
yeah.
Eh,
yeah.
It's not really much going on in it, is it? It's just a home invasion film. So what I've done this week is I've written a breakdown with all of the subtext.
Okay.
And then that way everyone's on board, right?
All right, yeah, I'm here. Right? I'm here for it.
I'll start. Here's the jingle.
We're having a break.
Panic Room centers on Meg Altman, a recently divorced woman, and her diabetic teenage daughter, Sarah, as they move into a high-end townhouse in New York City. Imagine that. Imagine someone mentioning you, being like, oh yeah, not my friend Ben, my diabetic friend Ben. That's one of your adjectives.
That's, like, honestly, I'd be flattered. I'd be like, that man cares about my health. You know what I mean?
The house is equipped with an expensive high-tech panic room, designed to keep its occupants safe in case of an emergency. This room becomes the focal point of the film when three intruders, Burnham, Junior, and Raoul, break in, seeking a hidden fortune in the house, a fortune they are denied by Meg and Sarah's need for safety. Subtext.
Okay, I'm with you. I'm hearing what you're putting down. Am I going to pick it up? Let's see.
You will if I've written it.
Yeah, to be fair. Meg uses the room's advanced surveillance and communication technologies, intercom and Sony CCTV.
It's 2002, Ben.
Yeah, sorry, my bad. Uses the advanced surveillance and communication technologies to monitor the intruders. But these advantages prove limited as the criminals become more determined and more resourceful. As the situation escalates, Sarah's diabetes becomes a key issue as she requires insulin that is outside the panic room, adding urgency to the narrative. The intruders, particularly Burnham, who is experienced with security systems, try various methods to break into the panic room, starting smart and ending up with brute force as they become increasingly desperate.
In the third act, Meg is forced to leave the safety of the panic room to retrieve Sarah's medication. This leads to direct confrontation between Meg and the intruders, ending with Burnham and Raoul now locked inside the panic room with Sarah on the edge of a diabetic coma and Meg outside with a gun. Burnham, the most conflicted of the criminals, shows some reluctance to harm Meg and Sarah, but Raoul's more aggressive behaviour highlights the darker, more desperate side of the class he represents. The film concludes with the police arriving just as the situation The film concludes with the police arriving just as the situation reaches its breaking point. Burnham, who tries to steal the money, is caught while Meg and Sarah are left physically safe but shaken.
To recap, a rich divorcee with too much money buys a house with $22 million in bearer bonds hidden in a safe she doesn't know about inside a panic room she doesn't want. And three upstanding, working class, proper blokes walk in. She gets all shirty about it, like a right bitch. Yet more upper class propaganda about rich people I can't care about because money makes you not a person.
I'd say that's an accurate representation of your feelings, Ben.
Kinda.
No, there's that. I think it's there if you want to pick it up. The idea that their money and their resources makes them safe, and the people outside of the representation of that money and safety are desperate for some safety of their own, but it's in the box.
Yeah.
And how do you get into that box as a working class person?
Yeah.
Do you do it by being a monster like Raoul? Do you do it by being an empathetic person like Burnham? As a class allegory, it's pretty thin, but it's there.
It is pretty thin, bud. It's pretty thin, but, you know.
Well, I think it intentionally.
Okay.
Fincher initially accepted the project because Fight Club, which was his previous film, was 150 separate locations. Now, bear in mind how many takes this guy likes.
Exactly.
Right, yeah, 150 different places. He said his whole experience of Fight Club was just waiting for trucks to be unloaded.
Right, okay.
And Panic Room was entirely self-contained. Like, Fincher doesn't write his scripts. He doesn't have that kind of interest. What he does is he acquires scripts and goes, that's a good test bed for what I want to do.
Yeah.
And this allowed him to plot out every shot, handpick every single bit of equipment. Oh, that's expensive and new. I've not used that before.
I love that.
He said to The Guardian in 2002, a movie is made for an audience and a film is made for both the audience and the filmmakers.
Ooh.
I think that The Game is a movie and I think Fight Club's a film.
Okay.
I think Fight Club is more than the sum of its parts, whereas Panic Room is the sum of its parts. I didn't look at Panic Room and think, wow, this is going to set the world on fire. These are footnote movies, guilty pleasure movies, woman trapped in a house movies. They're not particularly important.
That's a bang on representation of how I felt at the end of this film. I was like, that is utterly pointless, but fine.
Right. He said, I sort of feel like all movies, you have to go in with the idea that this isn't the one that defines you. Because I think people get too caught up in the legacy that they're leaving. And that's why I like thrillers. This is a popcorn entertainment movie for him that allows him to play with his toys. He's like, give me just one location and all of your equipment and I will just have fun and like learn some stuff, push myself.
I love this. I love all of this. So this is, I mean, for me personally, this was a huge step in a direction that I did not see coming.
Right.
Because it's a pure date movie. You know what I mean? You go to the cinema, it doesn't matter whether you miss a line of dialogue or not. It's just...
Oh, yeah.
You don't turn your brain off completely, but the twists and turns are sort of... You see them coming about half a mile away, right? So you can sort of like... There's a bit of playfulness to it. And I like that. I like those movies. They're fun.
Yeah.
But Fincher's films before this have gone from like big to bigger, right? Alien 3 to 7, huge step up. 7 to The Game, enormous step up, because now you've got San Francisco as one man's back garden. You've got The Game to Fight Club... was enormous, because like you've just said, 150 locations, the amount of reshoots and stuff, it would have been insane.
Yeah.
And now you've got this tiny, tiny claustrophobic set that like feels minuscule in comparison to all of his other works.
Oh God, yeah.
And that's great. That's awesome. It shows that he can do the big and the loud, and he can do the in your face.
Mm-hmm.
He can do them, and he can do them all well, right? He can do them great.
Right.
But now he can also do the very quiet and the intimate. And the closed off, you are in a fishbowl. The cats are swiping at the tiny fish in this tiny bowl, right? And that's an incredible 100%. Thing to do.
So Hitchcock, for me, is a big reference here.
Okay.
That kind of like thriller set with, it's all tone, it's all ambience, all that kind of nervousness, which you get in a lot of Hitchcock movies.
Where
it's not necessarily what's being shown, it's what's not being shown. And you're like, oh my God, they're outside the gate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The joy of this film for me isn't in the plot whatsoever.
Right, okay.
Like Fincher, yeah. I see it as a pretty boilerplate. It's a good script. Yeah. It'll do well as a date movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Bearing in mind, he's coming. We kind of look at Panic Room as the follow up to his magnum opus Fight Club.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But at the time, this was the follow up to his massive flop Fight Club.
Yeah.
That critics hated.
Yeah.
And everyone said was a violent celebration of everything that's wrong with toxic masculinity.
That's crazy to think about that out loud. Do you know
so
what I mean?
So this is him kind of having to go, no, I'm still a safe bet.
Yeah.
Look, here's your date movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But also, I see this as the first film that looks like a David Fincher film.
Right.
Seven and Fight Club look very similar. Dirty, noisy, loud. They're quite stylized.
Yeah.
There's quite a lot of like, I'm just going to call it out for what it is. Peak 90s.
It's peak 90s.
Chin stroking in the look. Do you know
yeah,
what I mean?
But he's also got this weird 70s grit that it's almost like the, you know, like Bullet and stuff like this. Like the old grit films. It's that done in a higher definition.
Both of them are quite reactive styles.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This film looks like Gone Girl. And like The Social Network. And like every other film he does going forward.
Okay.
This is the first David Fincher looking film, which is a kind of original style. And there's a reason for that.
Okay.
So the house that this is set in was built on a soundstage in LA.
All right.
By a guy called Arthur Max, who'd just come off the back of Gladiator, right? So he's just designed like massive sets. And then he's like, do one house. His 15 weeks and $6 million, Arthur. Go wild.
Wow.
So every room in the script was designed for the angles that David Fincher wanted.
Okay.
The height of the cast.
Right.
Was worked in. So it was also, right. So he built this house based on the height of his actors, where his cameras are, the size of his cameras. It's literally a custom playroom for a director.
Amazing.
He then models the entire house in CG.
Right.
So that he can do the shots ahead of time. Called Previs, basically, where he has a virtual camera in the CG house. And he goes, right, well, if I put the camera here, what can I see? Where will I need to light? Where can I put my actors?
That's incredible.
So he makes a low-budget CGI puppet theater version of the movie first.
Right.
With how deep the focus is going to be, how bright the lights would need to be. Over two-thirds of the shots in this film were pre-visualized.
That's nutty.
He wanted the film, he basically wanted the film to be done in pitch darkness.
Right.
Like as dark as possible.
Yeah.
But then realized that wasn't going to work. So he wanted it barely lit. Where like looking naturally dark, but you're still able to see what's going on. That's not the sort of thing you can nail on the day.
No.
Because especially this is on film. This isn't digital yet. This is his last movie on film. So he doesn't necessarily get to see what the negative looks like until a little while later.
Oh, that's a gamble, man.
So he gets everything ready. Everything is prepped.
Right.
And then it all goes wrong. So 18 days into filming, his lead actress, Nicole Kidman, discovers that she's got a knee injury from her last movie, Moulin Rouge, which means she can't work.
Outstanding.
Like it's killing. There's a Screen Actors Guild strike on the horizon, so he's got to find a replacement rapid.
Oh, I see.
Jodie Foster quits her position as president of that year's Cannes Film Festival and gets to set with 9 days of prep.
Wow.
All of Fincher's shots that he's pre-visualized are for an actress who's considerably taller than Jodie Foster.
Wait, Kidman's taller than Foster?
Yeah, by quite a way.
Okay.
The laser detector in the door for the panic room is literally lines up perfectly with the height of Jodie Foster's eyes.
Yeah.
Every time she runs in and out, she keeps blinding herself and not being able to finish the take. She finds out 5 weeks into being on set that she's pregnant. They've now got to shoot around that.
Okay.
Kristen Stewart's mid-puberty.
Right.
So she grows about 4 inches from the start of the shoot to the end.
Jesus, okay.
But these are all things that, like, Fincher can't... You can't control actor getting a knee injury. You can't control somebody being in puberty. You can't control somebody being pregnant.
Not yet, so but I imagine the second you can with AI, Fincher's going to be all over it. You know what I mean?
And then we get into, like, Fincher's love for take after take. So, like... 2,000 unique camera setups, pulling down the lights, camera, diffusers, electrical.
Hold on.
Setting up for a new angle 2,000 times on one film.
2,000 individual For this film?
For this film. And then also, each setup is hundreds of takes. So you know there's a scene where Raoul is trying to smash into the panic room from underneath.
With the sledgehammer.
With a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
They took 2 days filming that one scene.
It's 30 seconds, if that.
It's not even that. It's not even that. But he wanted take after take. But of course, they've got to reset the ceiling every time he wants to do a new take.
How? That's insane. Because he's breaking wood and everything else and plaster.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They just built huge numbers of ceilings.
That's insane.
And would just slot them in. There's a 5 second shot in this movie.
Yeah.
Which is when Meg is attacked by Raoul and she drops Sarah's medical kit. It's less than 5 seconds.
Yeah, yeah.
Over 100 takes.
That, okay.
Because he didn't want it to look like Meg threw the kit. He wanted to make it look like she lost it. Right. But it also needed to land in frame and in focus for his very narrow aperture, shallow depth of field shot that he'd set up on the floor.
Jesus, man. All right. I don't... Okay, this might make me sound like amateur when it comes to like filmmaking techniques and stuff. How much did it help doing the 200 takes? Like, is it...
I think realistically, if you've got a shot low on the floor with a really shallow focus, right? So something needs to land pretty accurately.
Yeah.
Trying to get it so your actor doesn't look like they're throwing it like a ring toss into focus, but they're legitimately having a fight and dropping it.
Right.
I don't know how much I care.
Same. You see what I mean? Like, how much does it bring to the table when it's less than 5 seconds of the film?
But then I think it also helps with that suspension of disbelief where it doesn't look like you're watching someone do acting.
Okay. I get that.
And when it looks like when you're invested in it and then suddenly, you know, Jodie Foster carefully tosses a medical kit across the room whilst having a fight with a mental ski mask guy.
There was many times that snapped me out of it before that moment. And I'm not going to lie, that was not even on the list of things that might have brought me out of it had it looked like she'd thrown it a little bit. To be fair, it might make sense that she'd thrown it because it's just sort of like, my daughter's in there. I'm not getting in there. She needs a meds. There you go. Get it in.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And that it still would have made sense.
Yeah.
It still would have been like, okay, maybe she can like appeal to the humanity of the criminals that are in the room with her daughter now.
Yeah.
That would have been fine. Speaking of this, I've done a little bit of research on Fincher himself, and I've got a quote from him here based on what you've just said.
Right.
I was watching through the director's commentary because they're insane with him in them because he doesn't talk about the film that's happening. He talks about how the ideas arrived to him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they are insane. Like, it is pure just... It's the most unhinged director's commentaries that you can get your hands on because it's mental... the huge amount of effort he goes through for the smallest things.
He's a nerd and I love it. Yeah, I just love the fact that I think what Fincher enjoys is the process of filmmaking,
which is incredible.
And he'll just do whatever he needs to do to make sure that he gets another go at the process of filmmaking, figuring out what he can do, because that's what he finds interesting.
Yeah, I love that.
Can I do this?
Will this work?
I suppose I'd better pick a script that will let me find out.
So the only thing I'll say about it is I watch films to escape, right? A little bit of escapism.
Yes.
Immerse myself in a universe that's not necessarily my own. It gives me a break from reality. That's why I watch films. That's why I like movies rather than films, right?
Right. Yeah, yeah,
I appreciate filmmaking all day long. I'm not a big nerd into it. I'm more of in universe.
You don't love cinema. You're just like, help me turn my brain off so I could not be me.
Yeah.
And whatever it is, you watch films like you watch YouTube, you know? It could be Dr. Disrespect as much as it could be David Fincher or Nolan.
I don't think it's the same. I don't think we can watch Dr. Disrespect anymore, buddy.
I think
that was out of pocket now. But it's more like I love movies. I like films, but I love movies, right?
Right. Yeah, 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 yeah.
So with that in mind, I went looking through the director's commentary, and there's this one bit where he's talking about there's a big propane explosion inside of the panic room, which was mental. It was one of the main things that pulled me out of the immersion, but it was fine.
I can see that,
Yeah, because they wrap themselves in fire blankets and set fire to propane that's actively being pumped into the room.
Also, propane sinks doesn't float, so like this them getting on the floor breathing is literally the worst place to be.
Exactly, but get up, right? Just stand up. It's fine. Anyway, the immersion broken to the side.
Fully, yep.
Right. After the propane explosion, Fincher chimes in with this thing, and he's talking about the lighting within the panic room. It's obviously like it's lit with fluorescent lights.
Yes.
And this is a direct quote from him, and I just, it's one sentence. It's going to take me a minute to get through it because it is long. But just, this is a quote from Fincher regarding the flickering lights in the panic room after the explosion, right?
Okay.
We had this flickering light effect because we wanted, after the explosion, we wanted one of the fluorescents to be screwed up in some way, and it ended up being such a hard thing to cut around because you wanted it to be erratic, but sometimes it just felt like when you cut, the lights had been off for too long or were flickering too fast or something. It was one of these things that you think is going to be a really good idea, but it ends up screwing everything up.
Yeah.
When he said this, I'm sitting there and I'm watching the film and I'm like, if you hadn't have mentioned that entire thought process about how the flickering light is hard to cut around, I wouldn't have even clicked. I would not have picked up on the flickering of the light behind Jodie Foster's head in one shot.
I think this is why Finch is called a filmmaker's filmmaker, right?
Got you.
Because the people that really rate Finch are the other people that make films.
Right.
And they see what he's done and how hard that is to do.
Yeah.
Whereas an audience member, it's a little bit like we don't know what's behind the curtain. So we just sit and we watch and we go, oh yeah, fine.
Exactly.
We view what's presented to us.
Yeah.
A flickering light on in a shot is in camera. You can't change that after the fact.
Yeah.
Fincher, in his next film, Zodiac, basically reacts to that flickering light in a big way. Quite a lot of the blood in Fincher movies is no longer practical blood.
Right, okay.
Quite a lot of objects that are thrown by actors...
Right.
Are no longer actually thrown by the actors.
Okay.
Because if he's going to get 100 takes or something,
yeah,
he doesn't want the perfect take ruined by something that isn't really predictable or controllable inside the shot.
Right, okay.
So like a practical blood splatter, he's like, that actor nailed that performance.
Yeah.
But the blood got in their eye.
Right.
And now I can't read, right?
Right.
No, have that. There's a scene in Gongo where she's throwing gummy bears at him.
Yes.
And he's like, we're not doing that in camera.
Wait, what?
We're just going to CG the gummy bears in.
Stop it. I can't wait to do Gone Girl. That's probably my favorite Fincher film of all time.
Well, and I think Finch is a director who has in his head how it needs to look.
Right.
And the process of him making a film is him having to explain to everyone else who can't see that what he's going for.
Right, okay.
And then trying to get it. Going, okay, this is the tools. These are the tools I have.
Yeah.
This is the, I've got these actors, this equipment, this set. This is what I think the shot can be.
Okay.
And then just trying to get it.
I mean, that's...
And a flickering light in camera is just a random... uncontrollable element, which is the antithesis of how Fincher makes films. He knows what he wants already.
I guess
he's already visualized how and when that light flickers.
That's insane to me. Like, that is insane. that's a type of neuroses that's like so focused on every minute tiny detail.
Yeah. Because the film already exists in his head.
Doesn't make sense to me in my brain. It doesn't make sense to me in my brain at all. Like, when we do these shows, we don't sit down and meticulously plan out every single line of dialogue. It's a literal, like, it is
right
headline. And then we waffle
right
and ad-lib and improv for how long?
Right.
An hour?
No.
That's mental.
He pre-writes every camera move, every little nuance, so that it becomes...
This is why he doesn't write scripts.
Exactly.
He would never finish it.
He'd never get one finished. He'd never get one done.
Yeah, he'd never finish it.
He would sit there debating whether or not the or an for
he'd be there, he'd be weeks. Like, but how many seconds do they breathe between the or an?
I genuinely, and when you said, you know, AI, I genuinely believe if there's one director who would wholeheartedly embrace the ability to have AI actors, it'd be Fincher in a heartbeat.
Of course, a programmable thing that's like meticulous down to like the nanosecond. Yeah,
he on this film he started his sort of habit for using motion control cameras rather than camera operators.
Right,
because he's like, I know if I hit go,
yeah,
it will do the same thing every time. I can't promise that from a camera operator.
Right. Okay.
It's a bit unfair. He does. Yeah. He does roll with punches, like on Seven, where Brad Pitt breaks his arm.
Yeah.
And he's like, right, okay, I'm going to build that into the script. I'm going to make that part of the story.
Okay.
This one, he obviously expected Nicole Kidman. And I think that's a huge change in the tone of the film.
Yeah.
Because with Nicole Kidman, she's much more of like a trophy wife, Grace Kelly Hitchcock style lead actress.
Yeah.
But like Jodie Foster spent a lot of time sort of carving out a little niche of the non damsel in distress character, right?
Yeah.
It's no longer, oh my, there's intruders in the house. It's like, get out of my fucking house.
Yeah, four.
No, that wasn't me swearing. That was Jodie Foster in character as Meg Altman swearing.
Got you,
so
got
still
you. Got
on
you.
Three.
Yeah. Got you.
I think it's a huge change to the tone of the movie.
I love the fact that Jodie Foster can do the damsel in distress, but also simultaneously be carrying herself as a heroine at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, I always struggle with Jodie Foster. I've never been like, oh, wow.
Same.
Jodie Foster. I've always known rationally that she's an incredible actress.
Incredible.
Couldn't tell you a film that I really, really emotionally resonated with her in.
I don't think there is one moment where I've ever fully connected with Jodie Foster any of her characters ever.
Right.
I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's fine.
I think for you, it's because she's a lesbian and therefore you just can't relate. You're like, nah. There's nothing for me there. It's because you're a misogynist, woman hater. It's because she's a strong, capable woman who you're not relevant to, and therefore you're just like, there's nothing for me there.
There's nothing for me there. Yeah. Well, I appreciate that little summation of my entire character in one sentence that is both hilarious and simultaneously devastating at the same time. Thanks for that one, man. But I think what it is, right? There's one character that I relate to more than others. And it's her in Elysium.
Right, okay.
Where she's sort of like controlling the immigration of the ring, the halo, right?
Right, okay. Is that because your racism comes out and you're like, yeah, keep them out. Keep them out, Jodie.
It's because I don't like people. I'd literally be sort of like, what you
make
think?
Elysium great again. Mega.
I'd be like... I think the only reason that I related to it is because like, if I was in that position... It would just be the people that I enjoyed being allowed on there. What, you think that normal people are going to come on to my mate's ring and use a med bay? Absolutely not. I don't know people. People are terrifying. Off you go.
I'm too straight for it to be mates.
It's fine. Sorry. You go one way, I go another. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But just feel like if people are going to try and come on my ring, then that's nothing I'm interested in.
That's a friendly experience if I've ever seen one. What says Christmas more than your mates just popping over to your ring for a quick chow or some
bay.
Dinner? Do you know what I mean?
For a quick med bay.
A quick lie down on your med bay.
I feel like Nicole Kidman in this would have been a much better film. And I feel bad for saying that.
No, I'm
but
in the
I
same
feel
boat.
Like it sort of lands in the Vertigo Rear Window space.
Yeah.
Where it's a character arc of a woman who we initially feel isn't capable, becoming capable.
Yes.
And then I'm like, oh, there's some movement there.
Yeah.
Whereas the second I see Jodie Foster, I'm like, she's going to stab them in the neck with a bit of broken pipe.
Same. As soon as Jodie Foster was in the panic room and those guys were in the house, I was like, she's not trapped in there with them.
Right.
They're
right,
trapped in there with her.
Exactly.
Like that's just how it goes. And it ends up being that. And I'm like, it's just Jodie Foster being Jodie Foster. She's badass as anything. Don't get me wrong. She is like badass. And she's always capable. It doesn't matter what character she's playing, immediately capable. I never have any sort of shaken faith. There's never a question on whether she's going to be able to deal with whatever situation is thrown at her. And it kind of, in a weird way... ruins Jodie Foster movies for me because it takes any ambiguity away. It's literally just, she wins. End of.
So Fincher was like keenly aware of this, right? So one of the early casting decisions was there is a subplot in the movie where she finally manages to get a phone working and she calls her husband.
Yeah.
Because the police are taking ages and the daughter's like, just call dad, he'll, you know. Yeah. They know they've got a limited time on the phone.
Yeah.
And so she calls him, his new wife picks up the phone, and then later in the movie, like, you've forgotten about that call, but he turns up.
Yeah.
Now, the original casting choice for the husband was Mel Gibson.
Yes.
And this is this is back before anti-Semitism issues and all that kind of stuff. And the reason Fincher wanted Gibson is because he was like, it's a stereotypical Hollywood hard man.
Yeah.
And I would love the idea of Mel Gibson turning up on the film and immediately just walking face first into a spade Amazing. And then just being tied to a chair for the rest of the film.
Yeah.
Because as an audience, we would see him and we would expect there to be a turnaround.
Yes. We'd be like, Mad Max is here now.
Right. He's Mad Max is here now. It's all sorted.
Yeah.
Then immediately bop in the face of the spade, you know.
And it gets just gets worse and worse.
Right. does nothing of any, like, you know, has no agency.
Oh, man, that would have been amazing.
And I think that's the original film. It's Nicole Kidman who were like, oh, wow, that's, you know, Satine from Moulin Rouge.
Yeah.
Locked in a room with her diabetic daughter. How is she going to cope? Oh, Mel Gibson's here. Oh, no.
Oh, my God. I would pay so much money to see that version of the film. So much money. It's unreal.
But that's not the one we got. We got different characterization, and I think the film suffers for it.
It does. Nicole Kidman is still in this film, although she's one of two cameos that I found in this film.
Oh, no.
Yeah, she's the voice of the new wife on the phone.
Well, I'll scrap that from the game.
Oh, no. Should I not do the other one?
No. Okay, yeah, don't do the other one. But although I now know you know it, it's fine.
I'm sorry.
No, it's good. I wasn't ready for this level of prep, mate. It's good.
I'm trying to impress. This is all I do every week. I'm literally like, A, you teach me so much stuff about filmmaking, makes me super happy, because then when I go watch Tremors, I'm like, yeah, but is the mise-en-scène really complimenting the film?
I have never in my life sincerely used the phrase mise-en-scène, and you know that full well. I have never once gone, I've never mentioned the mise-en-scène. I think of all the times on the podcast, the phrase mise-en-scène has come up. It's you using it.
To take the piss out of you. I'm so sorry. But yeah, sorry, man. Okay, I've talked a little bit about why this film suffers for me and why I couldn't really like fully immerse into it. But there are aspects of it that really hooked me in and got me enticed, you know what I mean?
Oh, okay.
So on my first watch through, I was like, these characters are thin and I'm not really invested in any of them. I don't really care about any of them. I don't care whether Junior gets his inheritance. Because it's Jared Leto for a start.
Yeah.
So the less he gets, the better. And then the rest of the people, I was like, Raoul's crazy. Burnham's the sort of wholesome empath that he plays in every movie. and then you've got Jodie Foster, who's like just insane, borderline Clark Kent without the glasses on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I feel like you're right about Forrest Whitaker. It feels like Hollywood in the early 2000s pushed him into a really unfortunate typecast role where it's like, he is a black guy, but white audiences, he's got a wonky eye, so he's sympathetic.
Yeah, but also,
it was like this kind of horrible, like,
yeah,
you know, that's just a guy, right? And they're like, no, but he's a, let's not forget, he's a black guy, but white audiences, don't be scared. We won't have him be a thug because he's got a wonky eye. And I'm like, the amount of racism in the casting decisions that Forrest Whitaker is given.
I know.
We want you to be a thug with a heart of gold, and people will know you've got a heart of gold because of, you know,
the
eye thing.
Yeah. And he's just stood there looking at him being sort of like, you know, I'm like an actor, right? I'm not defined by my eye.
By my race and my eye.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, but you know, as a white audience, we can feel safe around you, because if you ever threaten us, we'll just stand to one side and then we're invisible.
There you go. That's it. We'll just move slightly to the left and you will have to crane your neck so fast that hopefully... injury.
We've escaped.
Yeah. But I think it's down to Species, man. When he was in Species, he plays a powerful empath, and it's
right,
like...
Yeah. That's your role now.
Yeah, that was it. I think every
welcome
film
to the
after
rest
that,
of your career.
For about a decade, he plays like a really... It's either really empathetic or really sympathetic character who just understands the situation from every point of view, and it's like... Oh, he's just a balancing board now. This is what Species has done for him. A sci-fi film about a female alien trying to shag anyone and everything just to reproduce.
He was good in Rogue One.
He's great in Rogue One. He's incredible in Rogue One.
Only time he's not playing a sympathetic empath, he's playing a nutter. And I'm like, okay, I can get behind this. The eye makes more sense now.
Right? I love him in that. But the characters, the first time through, very thin, very sort of like wishy-washy. Mm-hmm. I was like, man, I'm not really invested. And then I said to you yesterday, I was like, I need to give it another watch because I need to get something from it. I'm quite negative at this point. I need to get something from it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went and did some studying, mate.
Right.
And I've come back to the table with something positive. I think it's a big positive because it's reinvested me into the film.
Mm-hmm.
So the way the characters are written.
Okay.
The film that you've just described is probably what the writer...
imagined, yeah.
David Coep or Cop had in mind.
Right.
But the film that we've got Junior, who is like the main criminal who's hired in these goons to steal
inheritee from the prior owner who knows he's going to get shafted in the inheritance, exactly. So he's going to steal the money first.
Yeah, so immediately we're all like, well, you know, the inheritance baby just desperate to try and elbow his way to the front of the queue to get the money before anyone else does. And it's like, you know, screw that guy. And then you've got Burnham, who's like a blue-collar working dad, who's like, I'm going to get in, I'm going to get the money, I'm going to get out, it's going to be good for my family, we're going to be set up for life, it's just, I'm in a pinch.
Yep.
I get this done, no one gets hurt, I'm out, I can forget about it, we're set up for life. I like that. I feel like that's a relatable way to go about it. Then you've got Raoul, who is like, who is the most unhinged person in any of...
He just did it for the love of the game.
He just loves shooting people.
Like, he just did it for the love of the game.
He loves crime. He's got such a chip on his shoulder. Raoul is me if I wasn't cautious.
Right,
the chip on my shoulder.
The class allegory. The class allegory of this is they've got all the money and therefore all the safety.
Yeah, right?
Safety and money being 100% the same thing in this film.
Yeah.
They've got a panic room because they've got money. Inside that panic room is all the wealth to make sure that anyone there can be safe for the rest of time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's the three guys outside. One who is the fallen from grace wealth. He's squandered his money.
Yeah.
One who's a sympathetic. He's kind of our audience surrogate as poor people. Because we're not relating to Jodie Foster.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
going, he needs safety for his family.
Exactly.
And then there's just Raoul, who's just like, nah.
He's the one with the chip on his shoulder that's like, I'm going to eat the rich.
That's you. It's you.
It's me if I'm left unchecked. I know about the chip on my shoulder.
Uh-huh.
I know about it. I'm very conscious of it.
Yeah.
If I wasn't...
It's just snobbery in the other direction, but yeah. It's
kind of is. That's bad.
If you were a rich guy, you'd have a monocle and you'd be like, oh, the paws.
I don't think I would. I think if I was a rich guy, I'd be...
You totally would because you're a poor guy going, oh, the rich.
No, I'm not going, oh, the
rich.
You
just look at the other group and go, oh, they're not people.
I'm not going, oh, the rich. I'm like, just appreciate your privilege. That's fine. That's it. Okay. I'm appreciating my privilege. I'm very lucky in most situations. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
Yeah, that's all it is. If I was rich, I'd be poor in a week because anyone would be sort of like, you got change? You'd be like, nah, I got a grand. There you go.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I'd be broke in a week.
Exactly. This is why when they talk about trickle-down economics, I'm like, nah. Give millions of pounds, up benefits by a couple of million quid and watch the economy sing.
Yeah, yeah, it'll go crazy.
Because all of that money would be right back up the top in about 3 weeks.
That's all it is. Poor people look after poor people because they know how hard it's been, right? And then that's
and
it.
And they buy stupid shit. And I know that because I buy stupid shit.
Oh, mate, 1,000%. That's five, by the way.
If you gave me a million quid, it would all be...
I know, we've had a lot of crabs this week as well, mate.
We've had some hideous crabs this
week. Awful crabs this week. Awful.
There was one eating a bird.
Yeah, I saw it. It's outrageous.
It's disgusting. Outrageous. It's an armored cannibal spider that eats its own young by the fistful and like, oh, it's so cute. I'm going to get it. It's a little plushie. No, you're not.
No, that's outrageous. That's like having a fucking Jeffrey Dahmer plushie just chilling on your bed. Awful. Awful.
God's only mistake after Ben.
So with David Coep's film in mind, I started looking at it and I was like, okay, so maybe I've got this the wrong way around. Maybe Jodie Foster isn't supposed to be the good guy that she's portrayed to be in the film because let's look at the ex-husband real quick, right? He's an elderly gentleman. He's a very, very wealthy elderly gentleman. And Jodie Foster is playing a jilted ex-wife who has been left for a younger woman, right?
Yep.
Jodie Foster's not an old person in this at all. She's not an older woman at all. She's what, like she's 30s, 40s, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, like yeah.
Spending millions on a house in New York, yeah. Yeah. How relatable. And but then I started thinking, okay, so this gentleman, I'm not entirely sure that when he made his money, Jodie Foster would have been the first one there.
Right.
Because when she's asked about what she does for a living, She says, oh, I'm just going back to school.
Just
going to go back to school.
Retraining.
And the realtor who's like, you should buy this house. He can afford it. And I was sitting there and I'm like, okay. So she's buying an outrageously expensive house, which is far too big for two people. Far too big spite an ex-husband who's left her for a younger woman. And I get that. But also,
her child is going to grow up believing in ghosts just because of the size of the house that she's buying.
Yeah, 1,000%. 1,000%. I mean, she's going to grow up needing therapy after the events of Panic Room. Let's not lie.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, she's going to inherit her mum's claustrophobia, that's for sure.
Yeah. And then that... And then it got me thinking, so what's different between Junior, the main criminal, who's trying to elbow his way to the front of an inheritance queue because he feels like he's entitled to that money, and Jodie Foster, who's spending millions of her ex-husband's money out of spite because she feels that she's entitled to it for being left for a younger woman. And I'm like, oh my God, it's the same coin on a slightly different timeline. Those two are like match and match. I don't like Jared Leto's character. I hate Junior.
Uh-huh.
I'm not a big fan of Jodie Foster's character, but that's for different reasons.
Right, yeah.
And then I started looking at like, okay, so where does everyone else fall? Where does Kristen Stewart's character fall? And who is she related to in terms of the criminals, right?
Right, yeah.
I think Forrest Whitaker, Burnham, and Kristen Stewart would be matched equally because they're both...
On the morality play.
They're both sympathetic to the other side. They understand the situation. They also don't want anyone to get hurt, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're also terrified. Both of them are terrified. And that's completely relatable. And I like those two characters much more now because I can see it that way. Where does Raoul fall on this, bud? The insane, trigger happy, I'm going to fill the room with propane because, how do we get the bonds out of the room if they're dead in there, mate? Propane,
love it.
Mate, we'll get in propane. Where's that on the morality scale? And that is like the low of the low, that I'm gonna burn everything to the ground, hell for leather, all of it up in flames.
He's the Arthur Fleck of the situation.
That's exactly what it is. And I looking at it from this point of view, it makes it such a better film.
Right.
I'm now all of a sudden I'm way more invested in the characters, because I mean the writer of the script, David Coap. Do you know what else he's written?
I haven't actually looked into that because I like Fincher, went, the writing on this one's not the rich seem to be mined that we normally find.
Okay, yeah. Fair.
I'm like, this is a technical masterclass, not a writing masterclass.
No, I'll agree. I think the changes to the film negatively affected the script, but I've looked into this guy and honestly, we've covered a bunch of his films.
Have we?
Yeah. Jurassic Park.
Hey.
The Lost World.
Hey.
You mentioned Spider-Man earlier. He wrote the original draft for Spider-Man
2002.
Hey. He also wrote Death Becomes Her, which is a great film.
Mint film.
Yeah, great film. War of the Worlds in 2005. Terrible
film.
Great film. But super fun.
Great film. What it needs to be.
Exactly what it needs to be. Yes.
Tom Cruise killing a man with a spade in a basement. Yeah. Yes, please.
Incredible. And then it takes a bit of a weird turn for a while, where he writes Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And then Angels and Demons.
Let's be fair, there's no way he's the only writer on those films. He's a team of 20.
Oh, yeah. There's a few on them. And then he sort of spins it all back around with the 2017's The Mummy. There you go.
I mean, I hear what you're saying. I mean, essentially, I think... To sum up your take on it, it's about a rich divorcee with too much money who buys a house and then three upstanding working class blokes walk in. She gets all shirty about it like a right bitch.
Yeah. That's the one.
Because she's a rich person, money makes her not a person, right?
So, they're not after her stuff. They're after their own stuff. It's just in her panic room. And if the escrow had gone through as it should have in two weeks, which is, you know, as we all know, escrow only works on business days. Thank you, Jared Leto. Idiot.
I just on the Jared Leto point, I adore the fact that David Fincher clearly hates Jared Leto as much as we do.
Yeah.
Because every single film, he's like, no, you're doing your own stunts.
Yeah.
And we're going to set you on fire.
Yeah, also.
Yeah, we're going to have you hideously burned.
Yeah. Also, you get the absolute mince kicked out of you in this one, bud. So enjoy this one. We're going to do 110 takes of this one. And then, my new film, you're in it. Also, you get shot in the face twice. 48 takes of that one, please, buddy. Let's go.
One of our very valued listeners got in touch with a story. One of their friends is working on a Jason Statham movie at the moment.
Okay.
And Jason Statham is also a producer on the film. And Jason Statham kept doing did about 30 takes of this one shot because he really wanted to get it right.
Okay.
And the shot was him kicking another man in the balls.
I'd do the same. Right. 1,000% do the same.
It's like, you're going to get your money's worth.
Yeah, you have to.
I hear that this film doesn't really connect. You're 22 years too late to the party.
Yeah, I am.
But I do think it's an important movie for Fincher because it's where he defines his look. But it's also another repeated... Every time I read an interview with Fincher, he says the same thing about every movie. And it's like, how many times do we need to teach you this lesson, old man? He's his own worst enemy when it comes to letting go.
Yeah, yeah.
So do you remember on Seven, we were talking about Darius Conji, the incredible cinematographer?
Yes.
Who makes everything look brilliant.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Incredible.
So he was on this movie.
Was he?
Yeah, for 2 weeks.
Oh, no.
He was supposed to sort of come in and help sculpt the underlit design of the thing. Fortnight in, he got replaced by Conrad Hall Jr. And Fincher says it's his own fault. He says, Darius is not a light meter jockey. He wants to be part of the decision-making process. This movie did not allow that, and it was incredibly frustrating for him.
Right.
Darius makes films, but Panic Room is a movie.
Right, yeah, there you go.
So he's come in, he's gone, all right, David, what are we doing? And David's like, we're not doing anything, mate. I've done it all. I've got 2/3 of this film pre-visualized. I know what lens I'm using, what angle, how I'm lighting it. Off you pop.
Oh, point and shoot, buddy. Welcome to the show. Yeah, you
right,
see that there?
Right.
Stand in front of it and do exactly what I tell you to do.
And he says about this movie, it was just over-controlled. You know, he said it completely removed the authorship by the actors. You need that. You need someone to go, you're missing something here.
Right.
I want people to feel like they can stop the train and say that.
Right.
This was not the film for that. As an actor, actually, you know the guy who plays the drill sergeant in Full Metal Jacket?
Yes.
R. Lee Ermey, right? So
yeah,
he's in Seven.
And he is.
He talks about David Fincher working with David Fincher on Seven. He goes, this is him about David Fincher, he goes, he's afraid to take chances. He's afraid to let anybody change one word in the script. He wants puppets. He doesn't want actors that are creative. If you're not worth a shit at acting and you're not creative, then I would recommend you go work with David Fincher. Because he won't let you act, even if you're a fucking good actor.
That's pretty intense. Okay. Jesus.
I think he talks about this film teaching him that he needs to let go.
Yeah.
He needs to stop micromanaging stuff, which is exactly the same thing he said about Fight Club.
Yeah. Dude.
Which is exactly the same thing he said about Seven.
This is crazy, though. It makes him so relatable because, you know, when we do creative stuff and then we send it back and forth like 8 or 9 times.
Yeah.
And go, is there anything we can tweak it?
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, there's hundreds of things. And then we tweak it and it makes literally no difference
to
anyone but us.
Yep.
Look at socials videos. They take a good few hours. I was up until 3 o'clock in the morning the other day making one. Do you know how many people saw it?
Fuck all.
Couple hundred people.
Yeah.
Couple hundred people. It took me about 4 hours to do that one just because it was fun. And every time I watched it, I was like, yeah, but maybe if I switch it out for this.
Do you want to know how much this made?
Yeah, hit me.
So this is David Fincher's highest grossing film since Seven.
Okay.
It made twice what Fight Club made.
Jesus Christ.
It made nearly twice what the game made.
That's understandable, but okay.
And it 2/3 of what Seven made.
Wow.
It cost $2 million less than Fight Club.
Okay.
And made twice the profit. This made $196 million.
Jesus Christ.
This was a massive hit.
Jesus Christ.
Massive hit.
I wish I would have seen this in 2002 because it would have blown my mind. In 2002, I would have probably seen 2 home invasion movies. And that would have been it.
The look of this film, I cannot get over. This film looks 100 times better than any Christopher Nolan movie, shot for shot.
Okay.
Christopher Nolan does incredible spectacle.
Yeah. He does.
And if there's a dialogue scene, it'll just be, you know, it'll be a functional shot that just allows the actor to deliver the dialogue and us to go, yeah, okay, I know what's happening in the plot. Fincher will go, how can I make this one shot art?
Yes, okay.
For everything.
Yeah.
And I do adore that. It's just, it's a shame it's on such a slight film.
Yeah. No, I agree. I'll agree with that.
What are you gonna rate it?
Okay. So coming to the show 22 years later than I should have, having been spoiled with decades of home invasion movies, arguably done better because they are movies, not films.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to put it bang in the middle of the road because it took me 2 watches to get anything from it. But when I did get something from it, it was fun.
Right.
So I'm going to give it a 5.
Oh, that's fair. That is fair. This plays so much to my... You're like, we've got the cameras we use for social media.
Yeah, yeah.
And like getting the focus right so that the background's just blurry enough, but not too blurry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then getting the lights just right so that I don't look like my naturally salmon pink self, but also that like everything else looks normal.
Yeah.
Is a nightmare. And that's one shot that I've had years of practice at and I'm still like, ugh.
Yeah.
The idea that Finch has done that 2,000 times...
Yeah, in the space of a few months is outrageous.
And it's come out looking like this. I'm just like,
That's outrageous.
For plot, it's a 4.
Yeah, entertainment-wise, I'm going to give it a 5. Filmmaking-wise, I'll give it a 10 because it's insane.
But that's... So I have to go with like a 7 or an 8.
Right, got it.
Because like just the sheer artistry of like, I'm going to make every frame a painting.
Yeah.
Is incredible. I can open this film, skip to any frame and go, that looks mint.
Yeah.
That looks mint.
Yeah.
That looks mint. There's a scene, there's a wide shot of them and it's like, it's a wide shot of the room and there's the 3 people all stood around the room and there's little details like Raoul stood in front of a doorway,
right,
which has got a very dim light on in the other room. So you can see the silhouette of his head, even though he's wearing a black ski mask. And I'm like,
got you.
That's not an accident.
No, that's not an accident. That is a very meticulous thing that's been planned out for weeks before. Even looking at an actual light.
So I'm gonna go 8.
Okay.
As a piece of filmmaking, it's an 8. As a story, it's a 4.
Sound. That makes sense. I can agree with that.
You wanna play a game?
I'd love to.
Panic Room Trivia Quiz, getting all the bits of trivia that mopping up all the gravy from the plate that we've not managed to get through in the...
Oh, yes.
So I'll start you with an easy one.
Yeah.
Nicole Kidman crashed out of this film.
Yeah.
But do you know where else she appears in the film, Ben? I wonder, do you know where else she has a cameo?
Oh, she's the voice on the phone. She's the new wife.
Oh, wow.
The voice on the phone.
Yeah. Wow. No, that was a good spot. I was as impressed as I was infuriated that you already got that one. Okay, next one.
Okay.
The sleepy neighbor that they managed to rouse from his sleep across the room.
You mean the Prince of Porno?
The what?
The Prince of Porno.
Why is he the Prince of Porno?
In the director's commentary, they call Andrew Kevin Walker's cameo the Prince of Porno.
Why?
Could not tell you.
But yeah, you're right. That is screenwriter of 7 and script doctor on Fight Club, Andrew Kevin Walker.
It is.
So there's the two I know that you know.
Okay.
Who was originally cast as Raoul?
Ooh. I'm not sure.
It was Maynard James Keenan, lead singer of Tool and A Perfect Circle.
Shut up.
Yeah.
Okay.
He had to turn it down because of touring commitments to Tool. But that would have been excellent.
That would have been incredible.
That would have been so good.
Yeah, that would have been amazing. I would love to see him play an unhinged criminal.
Right. Dwight Yoakam does the role perfectly. Like, there's absolutely nothing that Dwight Yoakam does that I dislike, but it would have been a nice little get. Now, speaking of aspects of the film that got you enticed, Ben.
Yes.
Kristen Stewart says she has plenty of fans from this film. Why?
I don't even want to know the answer.
Bearing in mind, she's a young teenager in this.
This is what I mean. I don't want to know the answer to it because I feel like it's going to be wildly upsetting.
It is.
I don't know.
Kristen Stewart has said that because of the close-up scene of her toes curling,
nah.
She has gotten plenty of fans that say they like her feet.
That's disgusting. She's a literal child in this.
I don't know how you approach an actress in person and say, I really appreciated the close-up shots of your feet in that film you made when you were a child.
Nope. Nope.
But clearly, there are people out there who are happy doing that.
That's the worst. That's one of the worst things that I can think of. Can you imagine being a fully grown adult actor and then having some lech just creep up to you at a convention and being sort of like, I saw Panic Room and I've been a fan ever since. You're like, oh wow, thank you so much. Yeah, that was one of my, you know, it was my early roles. I was quite young in that. You've got really nice feet. I'd be like, wow, okay, so this man's a predator. Security, anyone around. Can someone check this man's basement because he might have skin lamps? Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, that's insane. Yeah. No comment corner this week, buddy, because we've got a special episode next week.
We do. We're going to be taking a break from covering movies and we're going to have an open chat.
About the future.
Like, the future. We're going to do a little bit of a mental health check-in and then just have a full focus on that. Hit the reset button just for 1 week.
Yeah, and just, we got some stuff we need to address and we think it'd be good. It's still going to be fun. It's still going to be, you know, we might trigger warning for, you know, severe conflict, but it's good. It needs to be done and I think it will be healthy. We've also got a big stack of comment corners. So if you've written into us recently, it's not that we're ignoring you. It's that we're saving it up for an episode which will make sense once you've heard it.
Yes.
I do have to say though, we are not only available here this week.
Okay. What do you mean?
We are also available on the No More Late Fees podcast.
Yes, we are. Absolute belter of a show over there.
Really,
really
good.
We had the pleasure and the privilege of joining them on their show to discuss The Grudge with Sarah Michelle Gellar from 2005?
Yeah.
2004?
Yeah.
Great show. Go head over to More Late Fees and have a listen to that one over there.
100% do. Jackie and Danielle are incredible at what they do. Their show is very different to ours, but I think it worked harmoniously and I think we weren't too chaotic, I hope. I really hope we weren't too chaotic. We do have priors for just turning up on someone else's show and being like, hello.
We don't have to edit this week. Here's a joke about Hugh Jackman. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, we do that a lot.
But it was fun. It was chaotic. And it's not the best Grudge film, but it's the best podcast about The Grudge 2004. So
it is, right? Objectively. Guys, that is unfortunately all the time we have this week. Thank you so much for hanging out with us. It has been an absolute pleasure. It really does mean the world to us. We love you all from the bottom of our hearts.
We really, really do. Ben is now going to thank you for spending an hour of your week with us, especially at the start of the week, by wrapping up the thoughts, feelings, and subtext of this movie into a little Monday motivational pep talk for you to attack your week with, while I just do what society always tells you to do and consume.
I'm ill this week. I'm going to keep it short. All right. I think the main takeaway that we can get from Panic Room is eat the rich. You know what I mean? Burn them down. They have our money in their safes. And quite frankly, I want it. Junior ain't going to get us in there because he is a literal idiot. But what will get us in there is a sledgehammer and propane. So just as a quick recap. Panic Room's a rich divorcee with too much money buys a house with $22 million in bearer bonds hidden in a safe she doesn't know about in a panic room she doesn't want. The three upstanding working class proper blokes walking. She gets all shirty about it like a right bitch.